And presenting the paper today is Robert Reese, who is director of the Department of Arts at UCLA Extension Program, was formerly an editor of Dialogue, is now bishop of the LA Singles Ward, and is also a columnist for Sunstone.
Thank you. I suppose that there'll come a time in my life, in my 80s, where when I'm introduced, one of my notorious associations may not be that I was remembered as an editor of Dialogue. On the other hand, I've never felt anything but pride in that association, simply because I have felt that when Dialogue began, and when Gene England and Wes Johnson and other people began, they began something not only that was very important then, but which has touched the lives of thousands and probably hundreds of thousands of people for good. This paper comes out of my experience in the past 4.5 years of being a bishop and trying to make the gospel work in the church in a very practical way. During the past 4.5 years, as I've served as bishop of a singles ward, I've become increasingly aware that when we speak of the church, usually with a capital C, what we refer to is much more complex, more diverse, and more varied than we normally think it to be. That is, we all speak about the church and use the term the church as if we were speaking about the same thing. I've also become aware that when we tend to act and to govern in the church, that we tend to act and to govern in the church as if everyone had a common understanding of the gospel and an equal ability to live its principles. Because of this misunderstanding, we tend to misjudge others, to condemn them for not abiding by our standard of commitment and devotion, and to exclude them from what we experience as our more advanced and elevated fellowship. Our failure to recognize the church has many faces, and that we are all at different stages. Our failure to recognize that the church has many faces and that we are all at different stages of moral evolution along the continuum we call the plan of salvation impedes our spiritual work as both individuals and as a church. What is the church? Let me offer some possible answers without trying to be exhaustive. The church is the kingdom of God on earth, the political kingdom of God, an entrenched bureaucracy, a rigid hegemony, a safe haven, a rescue mission, an unfeeling monolithic social structure, a place of refuge, a male chauvinist enclave, an organization to take care of my physical needs. The church is my family. It is a rigid, narrow, inward-looking religious order. It's a cult. It's the true church. Is the church any of these, all of these, or none of these? The answer is yes, to some people. I once had a conversation in print with Carl Keller called Letters of Belief, in which we offered divergent views of the church. Carl said, "The church is a society that is indeed a clean, safe, hope-filled place. But it is also mindless, artless, anti-humanistic, simplistically nationalistic, crudely authoritarian, uninteresting." Carl had a way with language. I responded, "The church is imperfect. However, it is the best instrument the Lord has given our agency to effect his purposes. If it is at times inefficient, backward, repressive, it is also at times instructive, progressive, and liberating. The church is like us. I'll go one step further. The church is us. It is no better or no worse than we are, and that includes you and me, for the church is what we make it." I recently received a letter from a friend who had this to say about the church: "But I find myself more and more at odds with the institution of the church. My resentments about how women are treated and the authoritarianism that seems to be growing in this growing institution are making my activity in the church very uncomfortable. What seems to me a community of which I could feel a part is now a kind of machinery that moves the work along. My activity in my own ward seems empty and meaningless. I feel a part of a huge machine, and I don't believe in the machine anymore. I'm having another letters of belief exchange with this woman that I hope will eventually be published that does some of the same things that Carl Keller's and my exchange did. Another way to look at the church is to consider the variety of feelings that people have toward the church. Again, the list is not meant to be exhaustive. The following are feelings that people have expressed to me about the church. Now, as a bishop, you have the privilege of talking to a number of people in an intimate way about their deepest feelings, and out of that comes a very wide range of feelings about the church. Some people love the church, others hate the church. They respect the church, they fear the church. They are devoted to the church, they are indifferent to the church. They feel nurtured by the church, they feel excluded by the church. Some people seem to experience no negative feelings about the church. Others seem to be in a constant state of conflict with the church. Most people have more than one of these feelings, depending on their particular mood or experience with the church. Thus, there are a number of possible relationships with the church. Another way to look at this is that the church is a mirror. It merely reflects back to us who we are and where we are in our moral or spiritual development. In Herman Melville's novel Moby Dick, Ahab, in his mad pursuit of the white whale, nails a gold doubloon to the center mast of the Pequod, saying that the first person who spies Moby Dick will have the gold doubloon as a reward. As they seek the elusive Leviathan, each of the characters of the ship comes up and looks at the doubloon, and each sees something different. For Ahab, it is the prophetic emblem of his quest. For Starbuck, it is a Puritan sermon. For Stubb, it is the almanac of the zodiac. For Flask, the pragmatist, it has been a round thing made of gold worth $16. For Queequeg, it is, quote, merely an old button from a king's trousers. For the dark and ghostly Fadala, it is the sign of the devil. And finally, for the mad Pip, it is a reflection of the mad world. I look, you look, we look, he looks, we look, ye look, they look, and I, you, and he, and we, ye, and they are all bats. As Ahab says, this round globe is but the image of the rounder globe, which, like a magician's glass to each and every man in turn, but mirrors back his own mysterious self. Like Ahab's doubloon, the church is a mirror into which all of the saints look and see a reflection of their own unique individual selves. Understanding this may help us realize that there are a variety of views of the church, a variety of attitudes toward it, and a variety of possible relationships with it. To develop this idea further, I refer to the ideas of Lawrence Kohlberg, a Harvard psychologist who in the mid-50s developed what is now commonly referred to as the Kohlberg perspective. Kohlberg postulated that there are six possible stages of moral or spiritual development for human beings. Kohlberg's research demonstrated that people have different attitudes or motives for doing what is right depending on their level of moral development. At the first stage, people are motivated by the avoidance of punishment. Here, people see the power of authority as superior and tend to be obedient for the sake of obedience. At the second stage, people are motivated by serving their own needs or interests. At the third, they are motivated by the need to be seen as good in their own eyes and in the eyes of others. They have a desire to maintain rules and authority which support stereotypically good behavior. The motivation at the fourth stage of moral development is to keep the institution going as a whole, to avoid the breakdown of the system by fulfilling the actual duties to which they have agreed. At the fifth stage, there is a sense of obligation to law because of one's social contract to make and abide by laws for the welfare of all and for the protection of all people's rights. The motto for people at this stage might be the greatest good for the greatest number. Finally, the sixth stage is characterized by a rational belief in the validity of universal moral principles and a sense of personal commitment to them. At this stage, principles take precedence over law. Because his research has been primarily among white Western males, Kohlberg's theories have been challenged, and legitimately so, as having both cultural and gender bias. However, this fact only increases the validity of my point. because it suggests that the levels of moral development may be even more complex when one considers those unique characteristics adhering to women and to discrete cultures. For example, Chinese cultures place a greater emphasis on filial piety as a governing moral principle, and people growing up in these cultures tend to be more motivated than Westerners to strive for communal harmony based on empathy, concern for the welfare of others, and mutual benevolence. Carol Gilligan, in her book, In a Different Voice, argues that because women are generally more sensitive to the needs of others and more naturally oriented to taking care of others than are men, their moral values and their moral development are in some ways different from men's, and they have often been unfairly judged by men as being morally inferior. Gilligan challenges some of Kohlberg's ideas because she says they don't include that. And I've spoken with women who have taken the Kohlberg test to evaluate where one is in the scale of moral development and felt that they were at a lower level on the Kohlberg scale than they should have been because Kohlberg doesn't take into account the particular kinds of moral development and moral sensitivities that women have. Citing a number of studies, Gilligan says, the repeated finding of these studies is that the qualities deemed necessary for adulthood, the capacity for autonomous thinking, clear decision-making, and responsible action, are those associated with masculinity and considered undesirable as attributes of the feminine self. The stereotype suggests a splitting of love and work that relegates expressive capacities to women while placing instrumental abilities in the masculine domain. Yet looked at from a different perspective, these stereotypes reflect a conception of adulthood that is itself out of balance, favoring the separateness of the individual self over connection to others and leaning more toward an autonomous life of work than toward the interdependence of love and care. I think in the church, because we have not understood not only that there are a number of different stages of moral development, but that different sexes develop different in terms of their moral perspective, and that different cultures do as well, there is a kind of subtle spiritual discrimination and judging. I think that one sees this when one works in other than Western cultures, to see that the Eurocentric orientation has also influenced the church. That the things that we normally think of as being in the hierarchy of moral or spiritual values may not be common to all cultures. I sometimes do a little experiment at this point in which I can predict how people are going to respond to a certain situation. And this is the situation. You're at sea in a boat, and you have three other people in the boat. You have your mother, your spouse, and your child. You can only save one. Which one will you save? Someone says the child, and that is a predictable answer. I would also say that often when women are given this question, they say, well, there must be some way to try and save more than one. And they start doing this and say, no, the rules are that you can only save one. I can't choose. But you have to choose. Well, how many people in this room, if you were in that situation, would save your mother? How many people would save your spouse? How many people would save the child? Again, that's very predictable. Or two people would raise their hand on the mother, but that's only if they come from the Middle East or from... No, this is true. People from the Middle East, if you were to ask this question to a group of Middle Easterners, almost all of them would raise their hand on saving their mother. Some cultures, you would have more people raising their hand on their spouse, but we are a child-centered culture. And people, when you have discussions among people about this, and they say, well, why would they want to save their mother, for heaven's sake? And their argument is, it's again a very American and Western point of view, their argument is, you can always get married again, you can have lots of children, but you only have one mother. Well, that's a different kind of cultural orientation. The scriptures suggest that the Lord himself recognizes a hierarchical system of moral development. For most, milk must come before meat, and the light is added as we are able to live by the light that we have. The contrast between the Mosaic law and the Christian law suggests that entire groups may at times be at different levels of moral development. The children of Israel were incapable of living the higher law, and therefore they were given the lesser law, and as Paul says, that law was a schoolmaster to bring them to Christ. Generally, people do not understand that the lesser law was given to the children of Israel not as a punishment, but out of love. It was a loving father who recognized that insisting that they be judged by a higher law than they were capable of living would only place them under greater condemnation, and so he gave them the lesser law in order to bring them to Christ. I think there's an important lesson in that, and that is that in the church, it is important to recognize that people are at the moral stage they are at, and to expect them and to judge them by a higher law does neither the church nor them any good, which isn't to say that one might not try and nudge people higher and also nudge oneself higher to higher levels of moral development. But it is to assume that everyone, when we say certain things, it is as if everyone understood those words equally, and they clearly do not. The New Testament also recognizes different stages of moral development. For example, Christ's parables of the sower, the talents, and the wheat and tares recognize various stages of readiness to receive and embrace his gospel. Perhaps it would be helpful to look at a concrete example as to how the stages of moral development operate in the church. At the end of each year for the past 4 years, I've conducted tithing settlement, and in doing so have observed people at various stages of moral development in relation to this commandment and principle. Again, for the purposes of illustration, recognizing their limitations, I use Kohlberg's 6 stages. At the first stage, people pay tithing out of fear. They sometimes refer to tithing as fire insurance. Taking literally the doctrine in Covenant 64:23, he that is tithed will not be burned at his coming. At stage 2, people pay their tithing to be rewarded. We often hear people at this level tell faith-promoting stories about how they were down to their last dollar and had to make a choice between paying their tithing and buying a loaf of bread for their children. They paid their tithing and soon had a sumptuous meal on the table. I want to make it clear that I do not question the causal relationship between obedience and blessings or what motivates people to make certain moral choices. Nevertheless, often at this stage people say, I can't afford not to pay my tithing. At stage 3, people tend to pay tithing to get approval of their bishop, of the parents, of the Lord. They may pay tithing because of what people would think about them if they didn't pay it. At this level, bishops get questions like the following. My grandfather gave me $5,000 and he tithed on that money. Do I have to pay tithing on it too? Well, the church has wisely excused bishops from answering such questions by instructing them to refer people to the statement in the general handbook. At stage 4, people pay tithing out of practical considerations and for the social good of the church. They recognize that the church couldn't function unless they paid their tithing, and because they are part of the church, they see it as their responsibility to contribute their share. At stage 5, people pay their tithing because they recognize that they have made a covenant to do so, that it is part of their spiritual contract with the Lord. At this stage, people generally do not focus on the technical requirements, but are motivated by higher principles. Several years ago, I had my ward clerk came to a tithing settlement, and I asked him how he was declaring, and he said, well, I'm not sure. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, handling the ward funds, I realized this year that we spent a lot more on fast offering donations than we took in, so I paid all my tithing to fast offering this year. I said, I just need you to tell me, do you consider yourself a full tithe payer or not? And he said, yeah, I guess I do. So I let him declare that. At level 6, the highest stage of moral development, people pay their tithing out of a deep personal commitment to moral principles. At this stage, love is the motivating factor for paying tithing. At this level, people don't pay their tithing to get a reward. They don't pay it because they're worried about what will happen to them if they don't. They pay it because they recognize that in giving this offering in free will and out of love, their brothers and sisters are blessed, the progress of the kingdom is enhanced, and the world is made better. It is not unusual at this level for people to give beyond the specified 10%. I am arguing here that it is important to recognize that people are at many different levels of moral development or spiritual awareness. Often in the church, we act as if everyone was at the same level. Most of our church governance is performed and the majority of our teaching is done as if we had a common moral ground and a common understanding of the gospel. Because of this, we tend to expect more of the church than it can possibly give and a higher level of Christian behavior from some saints than they can possibly live. It is helpful to consider Kolberg's perspective in relation to church leadership itself. Again, we often regard church leaders as if they were all at one, that is, the highest stage of moral development. In actuality, church leaders, like the rest of us, are at varying stages in their moral development. At times, bishops, stake presidents, and even general authorities respond to us from lower levels of moral reasoning. More often, they respond from higher levels. Recognizing that church leaders themselves are in the process of moral development should make us more tolerant of their weaknesses, more forgiving of their faults. Let me give several examples of church leaders who, from my mind, acted on higher levels of moral reasoning. I know a bishop who, upon leaving town one week, made the assignment to his elders' quorum to paint the house of a widow in their ward. He came back on Sunday morning, came to priesthood, asked for a reporting on that assignment, and was told that somehow it didn't get done, that people had other things to do or things got in the way. There were a number of excuses. He said, "Brethren, I don't know what you're going to do, but I'm leaving right now and I'm going to go paint Sister Evans' house. You can choose to do what you want." There were some people who were probably disturbed that a bishop would leave a priesthood meeting to go do something like that, but I rather suspect that there were a number of people who got an important lesson in the aspects of true service and what the priesthood is really supposed to do. President Hubie Brown often exemplified to me the highest level of moral reasoning. On one occasion in the early days of the church, when he was in the first presidency, that is in the early days, but the early days of his involvement in the church leadership, it's a time when people came to Salt Lake from the far reaches of the world to go to the temple. And as sometimes happened, people came and left the Temple Recommends home or whatever, and some people were very particular about letting people in the temple without such a recommend. And in one such case, a young man and woman had come from someplace in the Midwest, couldn't find their temple recommends. No one could get a hold of the bishop or the stake president, so the matter was referred to President Brown, who came down and interviewed them and gave them a temple recommend and said, "In this church, we break rules, not hearts." Well, I think that was characteristic of President Brown. Reminded of the story of President Kimball, who as a member of a stake presidency, it was evident that they had a serious need for a stake clerk. They looked around and couldn't find an appropriate person to fill the position, and President Kimball volunteered to step out, not down, from the presidency to fulfill that position. That may be the only time in the history of the church that somebody in a stake presidency has volunteered to step out of a stake presidency and into a clerk's position, but I think it was characteristic of President Kimball's moral reasoning and the levels of decision he made that he would do that. The following Zen koan about fixed rules of morality may help us understand what happens when we judge others from our level of moral reasoning. This is a Zen koan called the Muddy Road. Tanzan and Ikedo were once traveling together down a muddy road. A heavy rain was still falling. Coming around a bend, they met a lovely girl in a silk kimono and sash, unable to cross the intersection. "Come on, girl," said Tanzan at once. Lifting her in his arms, he carried her over the mud. Ikedo did not speak again until the night when they reached the lodging temple. Buddhist priests, by the way, take a vow that they are not to touch women. He then no longer could restrain himself. "We monks do not go near females," he told Tanzan, "especially not young, lovely ones. It's dangerous. Why did you do that?" "I left the girl there," said Tanzan. "Are you still carrying her?" Recognizing that there is a variety of moral awareness should make us more tolerant of others. Some will be at higher levels than we are, and some at lower. But if we are all in progress among those stages along that continuum, if we see those of our fellow saints who are higher in the stages of moral development, we can learn from them. If we see those who are lower, we can also learn from them, and we may also be able to teach them. When I read this paper in Los Angeles last spring, Albert Peck said, well, how do you deal with people at the higher levels condescending toward people at the lower levels? And my response is, no one at the higher level ever condescends. If you're condescending, it's a pretty clear indication of where you are. And it's interesting to think about this. I had occasion to find myself operating at quite a low level of Kohlberg stages of moral development not long ago. There, in my ward, I had a member of my ward who was a daughter of a general authority, and she was a very fine member of the ward, and she left the ward and moved to the East Coast, and then she called me and said, my brother has just moved into your ward, and I want you to be aware of him because he has some serious problems, and maybe you can help. Normally, I would have made an assignment like that to the Elders Quorum President, but I thought, no, this is a son of a general authority. I should probably handle this myself. And somehow didn't quite get around to it fast enough, and the general authority himself came down and got the son into a drug rehabilitation program in another city. And I found myself saying, gee, I missed an opportunity there. Not to help someone, but to impress the general authority. And I had to say to myself, that's interesting what that says about where you are in the stages of your moral development. Well, one of the things I find is that as you move higher in the levels of moral development, you have to be honest with yourself, so there's a bit of honesty that I might lapse into. As Latter-day Saints, we need to recognize that there are many people outside our tradition who live at higher levels of morality, and that we can take inspiration from them and emulate their behavior. Here I think of people like Martin Luther King, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and Sister Teresa. But there are many other people in every nation and in most communities. Let me tell you about one such individual, whom I know personally. For the past 8 years, I've been involved in a series of exchanges between Chinese and American writers that have been taken place both in China and here. One of the richest aspects of these encounters for me has been the establishment of friendships with a number of remarkable people. Let me tell you about one. His name is Dong Yumei. He's the current secretary of the Chinese Writers Association. Though he's an atheist and a communist, he has a nobility of soul that we associate with people of great spiritual power, and he has taught me as much about love as almost anyone I know. As a young man, Dong Yumei was attracted by the teachings of Tolstoy. Because of this, when the Cultural Revolution began, he was branded as a right-roader and imprisoned. His wife was told that she could either divorce him or look forward to a life of deprivation for her and their daughter. He begged her to divorce him, which she did. He was then sent to a labor camp on the northeast coast of China and there forced to labor under extremely difficult conditions. He was later put into a community of actors where he was forbidden to see the sun for 2 years. He was beaten not simply for the things he did, but for the things they thought he was thinking. He had been beaten so badly that when he was finally able to look into a mirror, he was shocked to realize that he didn't recognize his own face. At one point, he was cast out in the dead of winter with no shelter. He finally found an ox hut in which he could stay, but he had no fuel, and so the only way he could survive the bitterly cold nights was to wrap whatever blankets he had around him and to run in place. And he would do this until he became so ill that he vomited. At times, the Red Guards would parade him into the street, make him kneel down, and then have classes of school children file by and spit on him. I said, how did this make you feel? And he said, I was not humiliated for myself. I was sorry that a generation of young Chinese children were being schooled in such brutal treatment of other human beings. Knowing that many people did not survive such brutality and others had committed suicide, I said, how did you survive? He said, I recognized that this was a great evil, and it was important to survive it, both to be a witness to it and to be a witness of it to others and to prove that it couldn't defeat me. While he was living such extreme deprivation, and as he was out walking one day, he found an old Manchurian who was ill and weak. Dong Yume realized that this old man, whom he called the old man Chu, was even worse off than he was. He took the old man into his ox hut and shared with him what little food he had. He scrounged food and fuel and over the course of time nursed this old man back to health. As he told me this story, I thought of the 25th chapter of Matthew. Inasmuch as ye have done it unto the least of these, ye have done it unto me. A scripture that condemns us all. This old man had grown up in what was called Old Beijing, and during the course of their friendship, he told Dong Yume many stories about what life in Old Beijing was like. And when the Cultural Revolution was over, Dong Yume began to write these stories down and to make other stories based on this man's experience. And this narrative has become one of the most important books in modern China. This suggests that out of love comes love, out of one gift comes another. I think it is helpful for us to recognize that all of us at one time or another have been at various stages of moral development. I am myself well acquainted with the lower stages. I have had church leaders respond to me from all six stages. As a church leader, I have responded to people from at least four or five of them. Robert Frost says that he had a lover's quarrel with the world. I sometimes like to think that this is a good description of my relation with the church. I love the church with all my heart. I love it enough at times to risk confronting it. I love it with wholehearted devotion, enough to try to change it. I think as we think about ourselves in terms of spiritual evolution, we also need to look at the church in terms of spiritual evolution. I see the church itself as undergoing the evolution of consciousness. Oliver Wendell Holmes, in his poem on the Chambered Nautilus, use that shell as a metaphor for our building more stately mansions. Peck describes the movement from undeveloped spirituality to spiritual competence as spiritual evolution. He says that this evolution is anti-entropic. It is the thing that works against the forces of the universe that pull us down. Further, Peck states that the force that drives the spiritual evolution is love. It is the force that pushes us as individuals and as a whole species to grow against the natural resistance of our own lethargy. It is the extension of the self. It is the very act of evolution. It is evolution in progress. The evolutionary force present in all life manifests itself in mankind as human love. Among humanity, love is the miraculous force that defies the natural laws of entropy. In response to the question, where does love come from, Peck says that it comes from grace. To explain the miracle of grace, we hypothesize the existence of a God who wants us to grow, a God who loves us. For those of you who have read The Road Less Traveled, you were probably as astonished as I was by what Peck has to say. He is the only other believer that I know who seems to understand that the purpose of our life is to evolve and to become God. He says, why does God want us to grow? What are we growing toward? What is the end point, the goal of evolution? What is it that God wants of us? All of us who postulate a loving God eventually come to a single terrifying idea. God wants us to become himself or herself or itself. We are growing toward godhood. God is the goal of evolution. It is God who is the source of the evolutionary process, and God who is the destination. It is remarkable to have that kind of reinforcement of one's own radical theology, which I think Mormonism is, on these points. My conclusion is that in the church, we are evolving, hopefully toward a place where we understand the processes that the plan of salvation entails, and that we understand that it is based on love. I've come to the conclusion that the purpose of the church, in fact, perhaps the sole purpose of the church, is to allow us to have four experiences. The primary purpose of the church is to help us experience the love of God. All of the church's programs and activities reflect this purpose, or at least should reflect it. I believe, for example, that locked in our deepest remembrance from the preexistence is what it felt like to be held in the arms of our Father and Mother in heaven. I believe that that was the purest experience we have ever had. I also believe that we spend our lives trying to get back to that pure experience of love in their presence. When we are truly in touch with that reality, we are motivated to do what is necessary to try and return to them. The purpose of the church is to make it possible for us to feel that love. I hear people talk from time to time, and was in a priesthood leadership meeting not too long ago in which someone said that the primary function of the church is to administer the saving ordinances of the gospel. I thought about that, and it didn't seem to really accord with my own sense of what the primary purpose of the church is, which is to has to do with love. But then I thought, I read an article not too long ago in which a psychologist postulated, based on a study of children who had been deprived of nurturing and what are the effects of that. He said, I have come to the conclusion that human beings have as great a need for human touching as they do for breathing and for sustenance from nutrients. He said, I really believe that that is an essential human need. And I thought about that in relation to the ordinances. The wonderful thing about the ordinances, and maybe the most significant thing about the ordinances, is it involves us touching one another. And therefore, it seems to me that in that experience of the ordinance, when we feel that other human being putting us under the water, laying hands on our head, helping us through the veil, whatever the ordinance is, we feel some connection to that deep sense of touching that we felt in the preexistence when we were embraced by heavenly beings. Having felt that love of God, the next purpose of the church is to help us love ourselves. And being able to love ourselves makes it possible to love others, which is the third purpose of the church. And after receiving that love from others, and receiving that love from others is the fourth purpose of the church. Everything else is secondary. The gospel doesn't make sense to me outside of these four central purposes. And I think we get in trouble in the church when we see it otherwise. Thinking of that reminds me of a story that Marion D. Hanks tells when he was first made a general authority. As he was going out on his first assignment, J. Reuben Clark called him in and said, "Okay, kid, don't forget rule number 10. And thus said, "What's that?" And he said, "Don't take yourself too seriously." And Duff said, "Well, what are the other nine?" And Brother Clark said, "There aren't any." Well, one could think about this in terms of love. Rule number 10 is to love, and there aren't any others. I was thinking about Kohlberg's perspective in terms of love. It seems to me that one can consider at the lower levels of moral development, love is focused on the self. We love ourselves, we love other things. And there is, I think, a great deal of the love of things in our culture, and it perhaps says something about our stages of moral development that we invest so much time in the love of things, including the love of money. The second, or the third or fourth stages of moral development, we begin to turn out from loving self to loving others. Generally, we begin by loving others who love us. At some point, we begin to love others, perhaps because we get some kind of reciprocal love, and perhaps romantic love begins at least at this level. At the higher stages of moral development, we begin to love those who do not treat us well. At this stage, I think we also begin to understand what the love of God is like. At the sixth stage of moral development, I think that we begin not only to love those who despitefully use us, but somehow, in some mysterious way, we begin to love those people whom we do not know, with whom we have no connection. We may pick up a newspaper and read a story about some mother whose children have been shot to death in some far corner of the world or some other place where people starve to death, and we respond to those stories out of love, even though we don't know those people. There's something deep within us that responds. I think ultimately, when we reach the highest stage of moral development, where Christ is, we not only love ourselves and love other people and love those who despitefully use us and love those people who, in some sense, may be seen as abstract, but in terms of our love, are concrete. But I think at this stage we also begin to love something beyond. We begin to love the world itself. We begin to love the world of nature. We begin to love perhaps even the stars and the planets and all their moons and all of their orbits and all of the things that somehow are part of this vast cosmos of which we are a part. Lately, I've come to a new realization about the celestial kingdom. I used to think that what I had to do to get there was to keep all of the commandments. And now I now understand that all I need to do is to live perfectly one commandment, the commandment to love. There will be many who are perfectly obedient to the law who will not be exalted in that kingdom, I am convinced, because their lives are based on obedience rather than on love. Further, I believe that those who enter that kingdom will do so because, having learned to love purely, they alone will be comfortable in the presence of the pure love of God. Others who have loved less completely will seek lower kingdoms. I believe that the celestial kingdom will be reserved for those who have learned to love themselves, others, God, and the world. The world, not in the worldly sense, but the earth. The terrestrial kingdom will be reserved for those who learn to love themselves and others, and the celestial kingdom for those who chose to love only themselves. The love of the first will be as bright and as warm as the sun, while the love of the second and third will be comparable to the light and warmth of the moon and the stars, respectively. Outer darkness is reserved for those who, in spite of all the opportunities given them in mortality, were unable to give or receive love of any kind. As Father Zosima says in the Brothers Karamazov, "Fathers and teachers, I ponder what is hell. I maintain that it is the suffering of being unable to love." Thus, outer darkness is merely the reflection of inner darkness, the heart of darkness in which there is no love, and therefore no light. Let me close by making a reference to Scripture and the Doctrine and Covenants, in which the Lord says that that the light which is in us has the possibility of growing brighter and brighter until the perfect day. If one thinks about the stages of moral development and sees them in terms of light, one sees that light has the possibility of growing brighter and brighter. As I read the Scriptures, I am convinced that light and love are probably interchangeable in the Scriptures. And that when the Lord speaks that in that sense of the light growing brighter and brighter, in reality, he's speaking about the love within us growing brighter and brighter until that perfect day, that is, until the day that we can love perfectly. Until we can, until we have arrived there, it is my hope that we will learn to love at whatever level we are and to strive for higher levels of love in this church, so that as individuals we can evolve in that way that ultimately will allow us to experience eternally that pure love for which we seek and for which we were born in this life to experience. Thank you. Okay, we have time for some questions if any of you have any. Yes, please. Scriptural reference, I believe, is the 84th section of the Doctrine and Covenants. I'm not quite sure. The scripture that says the light that is given to them grows brighter and brighter till the perfect day, but if you have a quadruple, it's under light in the index. Yes, please.
What aspect of the gospel we're trying to live?
Yes, a good question. The question is, does one find in the stages of moral development that people may be at different stages depending on either the context or the particular principle of the gospel they're trying to live? I often find myself, in fact, feeling at least that when I'm at the ward on Sunday, I'm operating at some of the higher levels, and I go home, and I may not, my wife may attest to the fact that there's some depression in my moral reasoning or the levels of moral behavior. But I think it is true. Part of what I was trying to say before is that depending on the context, we may, in fact, respond in a certain situation out of meanness and cruelty. The next day, something may happen that touches us deeply, and we respond out of compassion that even perhaps surprises us. So I think that, and I think, again, this is helpful for us as we relate to one another in the church, There's often, again, a quickness to condemn someone who may not understand what we understand or be where we are. One of the things I have learned as a bishop is I have to take people wherever they are. And I'll give you an example of this. I came back, I was in England a couple of weeks ago, and while there attended a very touching Anglican service and a very small chapel in Cambridge, and there were only six of us, and the minister, the priest, invited us to come up and surround the table when it came time for the Eucharist. And I went with the others, and it was a lovely experience, and I partook of the Eucharist. And when I went back to my ward, I was saying that this was a very deep experience for me, that it really, even though I was aware that this may not have been done by the priesthood, et cetera, there was a symbolic connection there that really reinforced my bond to Christ. And I spoke about this, I felt, with very deep feelings in this. Well, afterwards, someone reported to me that they had overheard a conversation of people saying, well, you know, if he feels like doing that, he has no right being a bishop. And then a member of the ward called me and said, some people were talking, and I assured them that this wasn't the case, but I really needed to make sure. Did you drink the wine? And I thought to myself at that point, as I felt that I was having an experience at level six, and here was a question coming from level one. It would be very, the easiest thing to say would be dismiss that. The other is to stand. That's where that person is. So I had an interview with that person later and tried to say, tell more about what I was experiencing. And his response again was, look, the Lord told Joseph Smith that they were all an abomination in his sight and you should go no more after them. And, I mean, he really was staying at that level and I couldn't nudge him up a little bit. But maybe at some point he will nudge up a little bit. Yes, question. Good question, Richard. To what extent does the emphasis in the church on obedience tend to confine us to the lower levels? It's an interesting question as to whether or not whether that emphasis is because we choose to be at the level where obedience is important to us, or whether we push beyond that, or whether that is an unconscious recognition that we are no higher than at those levels. I don't know. It's a very interesting question. Many people seem to be more comfortable with obedience because it is a very tight, confined, safe world to just operate on that level. It is much more dangerous and risky to move out of that because the choices, the moral choices, become much more complex. Hopefully, someone told me the other day that the city of Enoch had reached a terrestrial level and they were translated. I always assumed they were at higher than that. If they were at the terrestrial level, what does it say about the rest of us? I do feel that there are some people, just as there, one thinks about this in relation to one's children. There's a certain point, and Kohlberg uses this idea in relation to the evolution of children, there's a certain point in which obedience is what children have to learn. But if a 30-year-old is still going to a parent wanting to know what the bounds are and still operating on them, then something is wrong. So I think that we need, as individuals, and I hope as a church, to get beyond those rudimentary stages of moral development to push to those higher ones where the spiritual excitement really is. There's not much spiritual excitement, it seems to me, in staying at the lower levels of strict obedience. But I think the other question, another way to answer your question, Richard, is to say that there are some church leaders who see obedience as being at the highest level. And we sometimes quote scriptures, to obey is better than sacrifice, et cetera, et cetera. There's a certain point, I think, at which obedience, and this becomes perhaps a kind of Zen answer, obedience becomes a natural spiritual response, not out of obedience, but out of something beyond obedience. It's a very good question. Yes?
Scott Deck says, before you get high level, it's called mysticism. There's a transition stage you go through called skepticism. Mm-hmm. You found that, and then 6 points you've outlined, is there a level of skepticism, or does that blend all the way through?
question is whether, referring to Scott Peck, who says that before you reach the highest level, which is a mystical, the mystical level, that you go through a phase which is skepticism. I don't think skepticism exists on the lower levels of moral reasoning, basically. I mean, the world at that point, I think, is too tight and too confined and too regular. I think it's when you get into, that is, it's at levels 4 and 5 that ambiguity really comes in. When a moral choice, when you're confronted with a moral choice, and it's not an easy one. You know, do I respond to this person in need or that person in need? Try in one's mind to weigh the needs of somebody who is in one's ward who is talking suicide and one's wife who is angry that one isn't home or whatever. I mean, there are a number of choices and obedience here. Do I obey? You know, I've been doing some work on Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Does Bonhoeffer obey his sense of what the church says, or does he obey his sense of what he says, or what something inside of him says? The skepticism, I think, begins to operate at that point where ambiguity comes in. And that's why I think a lot of people move up there and they come right back down, because it's so uncomfortable to be in that state of tension where the moral answers are not easy, where choices have to be made in their hard choices. Yes?
At what level would free agency be, above or below obedience?
Well, I think that hopefully free agency operates at all of the levels. The question is, where is free agency, above or below obedience? Some elements of free agency operate, I think, at all of the levels. I mean, a person does exercise agency to be obedient. Hopefully. I think agency becomes more meaningful when, again, the choices become more complex. And I think that ultimately the reason why we're given the gift of agency, so that we arrive at the point where we use that agency to make the highest moral choices. Robert? I think there probably are some situations in which obedience in a pure, strict sense might come in conflict with a moral choice. Well, certainly it did with Nephi. Is Nephi obedient to the law of Moses that he has been taught and it's ingrained in his blood? Or is he obedient to this other voice that's saying, kill him? That's a moral choice. The question is, when one looks and sees the suffering of the world and the suffering of others, and one sees, I suppose you're saying that some church leaders or other leaders who don't seem to share that concern or empathy, are you alone in that feeling? One of the reasons... I think that at the higher levels of moral decision making, perhaps an indication of whether we're not at those higher levels is whether or not we are disturbed by cruelty to others, to other creatures, cruelty to the earth. Again, one of the questions to ask ourselves is in terms of what is happening to the environment around us, what is happening to our lakes and our rivers and our trees and our canyons. If we really are at a higher level of moral understanding about that, we would understand that it is the generations coming that we have empathy for. The Iroquois have a principle, which is no decision is made that would adversely affect the ninth generation from that point. Well, if our empathy, if our love extends to 9 generations ahead of us, then the decisions that we make out of love will be very different than if our scope is how much money we're going to get or whether or not we'd be able to do something for ourselves. There, and again, I think part of it has to do with how we see the fragile connection of all living things, and even those things that we don't consider living, but which are living, which is the earth itself. How do we respond to that? How do we respond to cruelty in any of its forms? I think when one, I mean, it's Schweitzer's respect for life and all things living. It is getting to that point where you are even aware of the tiniest implication of something you might do that might affect some other living creature. Yes?
Just a quick comment and a question. There are 5 and 6, but in any event...
Okay, let me respond to your statement, then I'll listen to your question. The statement had to do with Kohlberg's limitations, and I was trying to make it clear that I was staying with those 6 only for purpose of convenience, recognizing that they are limited. And I think one of the greatest limitations is that they do that it is difficult in Kohlberg's scheme of things for women to reach the higher levels. And I asked several women to give me an example that I could use in this talk of something that happens in the church that would be an example of a woman's moral development that was different from a man's. I couldn't get one, although I'm sure there are plenty. Let me say just that my own sense of this is that one of the greatest injustices or greatest kinds of injustice in the church is when I think the church basically, because Kohlberg's perspective is Western male-dominated, I think it simply reflects the bias of our general culture, which is also reflected in the church, which is a Western male prejudice or bias. And I think because of that, we do not value the kinds of moral decisions and the kinds of moral evolution which women are capable of that men seem not to, at least in our culture. So now your question.
Okay, now my question is, I am a bit of a pragmatist, but what do I do?
Okay, good question. Don't know whether I can repeat it all. They want me to repeat all these questions here. But it has something to do with what does one do when one recognizes that forgiveness is at a higher level of perhaps of moral reasoning, and yet one hurts from a decision which is made from a lower level. Well, first of all, I think one has to say, if you hurt, you hurt. Wherever you are, you are. One of the things that has been uncomfortable for me is to recognize that try as I might sometimes, I really want people to be punished for what they do to me. Try as I might to act out of higher motives, when I'm hurt, I want to hurt back. There are times when I don't, but there's still times when I do. But I think also on a practical level, one has to say, out of love, it is a motivation to change a system, to make it more responsive to a greater number of human beings. And if someone acts out of a lower motive that affects you, and you feel that affects you and other people spiritually, then it seems to me you have a moral obligation to try and bring about change. And part of the difference here, and I think maybe it's a subtle one, is to see, I recently had a sister-in-law who had a very difficult time with a bishop. The bishop had treated her husband in a very unkind way. And she, this was a situation which, if I had time to explain it, you would see more about it, but she went to him and tried to resolve it. Out of love, she went to him. It was very hard for her, and he just brushed her off. And she wanted to get a temple recommend, and she said, but I don't feel comfortable going to this man, and yet I want to go to the temple. And I've gone to him on 2 occasions. In fact, I've invited him into our home, and he treated my husband again in a very unchristian way, and I'm really angry with this man, and yet I want to go to the temple. I said, why don't you go talk to your stake president and explain to him what the situation was? Well, she did. She talked to the stake president, and the stake president was somewhat sympathetic, but said, you know, he's a good man. He has his limitations, but he is a good man. And I said to her, Jerry, I said, it's important for you to recognize that you've made 2 or 3 attempts. He's not moving from where he is. He's not hearing you. He's not really responding. And yet I also hear what you're saying, is that you don't feel comfortable going to the temple when you have these feelings toward this person, or getting a temple recommend for him from him. And so I said, I'm also a pragmatist. I said, he goes on vacation. When he does, his counselor is given the temple recommend book. I said, go to his counselor and get a temple recommend, and you've done what you could to resolve the feelings. And he is, in many ways, this bishop is effective. He is not a very empathetic man, and that is his limitation. And you can't, you know, you've tried and you can't move him from there, so try and do something else. I don't know if that answers your question or not. I feel it only partially does.
Yeah.
Your question back here. That's a very good question. Let me try and rephrase it or to summarize it. It's when you evolved a certain level of moral understanding, is it possible to have kind of intimate associations with people who are at lower levels without somehow being affected by that?